I'm interested to know, Steve, how you arrived at the works that involved large groupings of individuals, and particularly the West London Social Resource Project.
Two projects sort of preceded the work, which was the Man from the 21st Century project, which was perhaps the first real attempt at constructing a work for an audience that was likely to have art as a low priority. In other words, you could sort of pretty well pre-specify that kind of a level of response to art. Man from the 21st Century is kind of interesting because it was, prior to that, I'd done a number of works which had been educational projects for different districts of Ipswich. I was teaching at Ipswich at the time, and these works I'd done with the students, and the idea had been that we're utilising certain sociological techniques to gather data for works that would then be directed at the people that the information had been gathered from. However, Man from the 21st Century was rather different in the sense that it was seen as a work of its own right. It seemed at that point that art had gradually become more and more removed from the social context. I mean, there are many reasons for this, but these are sort of detailed numbers of texts that I've written. But the general feeling was that there was a sort of state of separateness. Art had become rarefied, internalised, and had essentially become dependent on the institutions of art, and also the audience was the members of the same community that the artists essentially belonged to. It seemed that this state of affairs was not a good one, that if art was to try to relate to its setting, that it would have to externalise beyond this community, beyond what I call art social environment, and would have to extend into the sort of very fabric of society, and would have to become a much more central feature of people's priorities, and it would have to concern what was meaningful to people, or they would have to, problems of relevance, meaning, and social territory would have to be examined. Well, it was seen that the traditional sort of strategies of art, if you like, the traditional conventions, were of little use to the artist in making that kind of move. After all, they'd been developed within the institutions of art, they'd been developed within certain social climates which were part of a previous age, that the social climate had changed. And that the artist would have to devise totally new methodologies, objectives, and consider quite different kinds of territories. So we had what I, at that time, began to see as what I call an optimum model of art. This would be that the work of art would be dependent on three main factors, and that was the intentions of the artist, the social context in which the work was to operate within, and the composition of the audience. Those three variables in themselves were seen as interrelated, i.e. the intentions of the artist would also be dependent upon the other two factors. The work of art was a product of considering these three variables, and would be these three variables having been defined, if you like, in front of the work. This is quite a different approach to the traditional view of a work of art, where the audience is sort of tacitly presumed and certainly not specified in advance of the work, or that the work be determined in terms of what would be appropriate methodologies for that particular audience.
So not only did you specify the audience, but you used methodologies which really depended on the highly interactive process on the part of the audience.
Well, that was seen as, if you like, an appropriate methodology. What was important about Man from the 21st Century, going back to that project, was that in saying that the traditional methodologies were of little use in the direction that the work was to take, it should be said. It didn't mean to of little use within the original conditions in which they were devised for. Now, the actual work itself was in fact based on a combination of sort of advertising methodologies and methods used in sociology. However, the West London work, which you know came a year or so later from the man from the 21st century, had it sort of extended the methods from man from the 21st century quite considerably. See, there was also another work called the Social Resource Project for Tennis Clubs, and that work, which wasn't completed, you know, a lot of the methodologies began to be ironed out. I mean, for instance, participant gathering techniques or the development of problems as a way of setting up interactive relationships between the work and its audience and things like that. And but the West London project was the first really successful work, I mean, as a total entity. In other words, that it achieved more than the original objectives, more than we anticipated in the beginning of the work. And, you know, it functioned over the intended period of time. I mean, it wasn't all the intended parts of the work, if you like, and there were many events that occurred through time, took place in the order that we wanted them and so on. So, you know, really, that's the sort of... That would be the first work.
Mm. I think one of the, I mean, interesting things is the way in which, you know, the art that you're concerned with functions very much within groupings that have no prior knowledge of art. And this is, again, something that distinguishes the projects.
Yeah, I think the thing is that previously there's been a sort of separation between people with what I call distance models of art and people with intimate models. The formation of a model through direct experience and through indirect or relayed experience. And previously this has sort of tended to separate, you know, sort of the boundaries between art social environment and that of society generally. And these works were devised to operate within such a territory where generally they were distance models of art were held, you know, by the communities and so on. I mean, that just reflects a sort of generally the low priority art has within most people's lives. And this, as a work, had to kind of deal with that problem, and it was seen and recognised that there was the problem. Either we would have to change the priorities of people prior to operating the work, which might be a very lengthy process, so that they could then attend some traditional institution. Or alternatively, we worked within those priorities and gradually they would change them, but, as it were, rather coaxing them out of the position or taking them out of their original state through a self-paced type of process, so that they were gradually internalise the new operants or the new ways of looking at things that were being placed in front of them. Mm. And it wasn't really necessary for them to... we weren't trying to change the way in which they view art. I mean, this is sort of, would be a misconception to think that. It was a work of art that was concerned with its audience remodelling, which is the word we use, how they perceived an environment that was already meaningful to them.
Through observing kind of life codes, which...
Through engaging in the work. Well, yes, this involved how they viewed the coding structures within their neighbourhood environment, in the case of the West London and the Edinburgh work, and the relationship of these coding structures to behaviour parameters, needs and sort of priorities that they had within those kinds of neighbourhoods. So the first part of the West London work, which was descriptive in the sense that it concerned how a person saw the environment as it was, and the latter part was prescriptive in the sense of concern how they would change or restructure that environment. And it was quite clear all along, you know, that the traditional methodology is just not appropriate in that kind of context. I think in the past various attempts have been made by artists to change the social territory of art, but using the same methodologies that have been evolved in, you know, its previous territory.
There are lots of things going on, obviously, within the West London work. Mm. I mean, it's very kind of complex work, and one can look at it from different ways. But one of the fundamental things that seem to be one of its concerns is the kind of self-deterministic elements of the work, you know, i.e. that individuals are being directed toward this notion of effecting changes, or at least proposing changes in codes of existence, codes of perception that perhaps they hadn't examined before. You know, so it seems to come very much back to the individual having a, or bringing changes to bear upon his own existence, both in a psychological sense and in a material sense.
Yes, but also it should be pointed out that one of the objectives of the work was the development of a kind of consensus model. This is in all these works, such as the, you know, the Edinburgh and the West London and the Oxford and so on, that there was this element within the work of making a person aware of other norms or other yardsticks for viewing the world. And that the participant was just not concerned with his own models or his own perception, he became concerned with those of other people. Mm. And at the end of the project, with the final project models, where people were asked to vote on their preferences from models displayed, you know, locally through the libraries, you know, they were building up these consensus models, and then people were voting on models other than their own, and other than their own sort of social, sort of participant group.
In fact, this was one of the objectives of the work as well, wasn't it? That people were able to observe other people's...
To involve them in the psychology of other people, to involve them in the way other people perceive the world and acted within it. And it was seen that all these works have underneath it this sort of notion you talk about self-determinism. Well, this is one of the fundamental notions to all these works. And, you know, the work itself was seen as a sort of social model in this respect, seen as a model that reflected social tendencies and been taking or evolving certainly since the last war. So, you know, the work was seen as a relativistic work, making people aware of their relativism, if you like, or also a work that was based on notions of cooperation, the idea of cooperative behaviour, the idea of tolerant set of relationships between people within this, you know, within a structure and so on. I mean, the work was fundamentally drawn out of ideas that I'd written in a paper called Life Codes and Behavioural Nets, which is the idea of a net-like structure within society as a decision-making organism, rather than the traditional sort of unidirected hierarchical process, which you were saying earlier, or I've said in a number of papers, has typified the sort of machine age culture as a sort of decision-making model. It seemed to me that the decision-making was the very parameter, or, you know, was one of the very parameters of any social structure. It was the way in which a social structure made decisions really reflected the fundamentally the ideology of that particular structure. I mean, so if you build a model, in building a model, one built one up of its decision-making processes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've mentioned very generally the organisation of the project. I think it would be interesting to describe in detail, you know, the kind of strategies that you included and employed in the project in terms of its practical execution.
Fundamentally, they used a combination of what I call task-orientated methods. It was used in conjunction with passive methods. Now, the difference that I make between these two methods is that a task-orientated methodology involves somebody, quite literally, in completing some task. In other words, they are acquired information, or they acquire a perception by interacting with in some designated area. Passive methods, on the other hand, are much more a cognitive involvement. I mean, they don't require any actual interaction. You know, the fundamental basis of any task-oriented method is that it, of course, is interactive in some way or other, and this is what I was interested in. Again, it's a difference between acquiring a sort of a particular cognition through actual experience and then through relayed experience. What the West London work did, it asked somebody to cognitively interact with the world around them. And the tasks which the person was asked to complete was, if you like, the media for doing this. Now, the tasks themselves were constructed around problems, and the problems were framed as questions. The problems asked a participant to provide a solution. Now, a problem might say something like, draw out an existing map of your neighbourhood, and then how would you reorganise it given these conditions, or something like that. Now, the person would be asked to sort of develop a model. I mean, they might do a diagram or writing and so on. You know. So that, there was that aspect of the work which used these tasks which were presented in two books as a series of sort of questions. And two books, one called the West London Manual, one called the West London Remodeling. And the manual concerned people's descriptive sort of representations of their environment. You know, simply throughout the book there was just a sort of sequence of questions concerning how somebody perceived their the existing environment. The remodeling book, as we've said earlier, was associated with the that aspect of the project that concerned how people would initiate changes and so on. These methods were initiated as a process through time, some 9 months in the case of the West London work. And they were reinforced, as I say, by window posters and so on, which were in all the passive area, and the monitor boards, which were set up in the libraries and so on. In fact, I would think that the monitor boards were really the key to the whole project.
Using your sort of original intentions, which I suppose is the only way one can really finally evaluate the work, you know, what was the conclusion to the project?
Evaluating the work is quite interesting. In some respects you can evaluate it much more so than traditional work of art, because there is evidence, if you like, of people's participation. However, it's very difficult to evaluate the actual content of the work because it's so contextualised. When somebody's talking about a front gate, they're talking about their front gate, and if you have no access to that front gate, it's very difficult to understand quite the references they're using. So here we're dealing with a very contextual work that reflects that contextualisation. However, what we can discuss, and you know, this is what one generally refers to, is the length of time people are involved in, the numbers, and so on. First of all, I think that one should say that of 1 in 4 people originally asked to participate in the work, but they're at the end of the work. I mean, they've completed, if you like, the work. So this represented some 9 months of involvement at different points. Now, within that 9 months they might have attended actively to the work for some 15 hours. This seems to be considerably longer than a person would normally attend to a work of art. Also, if one is looking at the content, one can say a few things. One can say that the way in which somebody perceived these structures within their neighbourhood did begin to sort of develop away from their own norms to including those of other people. So you've got this sort of gradual development towards a more sort of relative way of looking at the environment. This is a thing that can be seen. Other than that, of course, there's personal testimony and so on. But I think the main way of evaluating the work is by saying that, quite simply, that here was a set of routines which somebody was asked to engage in, which would have been very unlikely that they would have engaged in normally or done spontaneously. One in two people asked to participate said that they would, and from the one in two that said they would, one in two again completed it. There we get our original figure of one in four. This seems to me a substantial number, I mean proportionately, a concern with the work. Also should be mentioned, in fact, that the work just didn't involve just participants. I mean, when discussing the work, we tend to make a distinction between what I call a primary audience and that of a secondary one. The primary audience is the people that are called participants who, you know, decided to engage in the work actively. The secondary audience is people that witnessed the work. Maybe they were friends of the participant, neighbours. Maybe they were people that just went to the neighbourhood libraries. This secondary audience was far larger than the primary audience, I think.
You attended a great deal to the constitution of the audience for the West London Project, didn't you? I mean, you chose specific areas for specific reasons. Mm. In fact, in West London, perhaps you could expand on, you know, why you did that in that way.
Developing this notion of the optimum model, we decided to specify the audience in advance and, if you like, to engage in some reconnaissance trips to ascertain suitable sites for the work before the methodologies were in fact devised.
But that is interesting, isn't it? Because that is contrary to most sort of conventional approaches.
Oh, totally,
to art.
Yes. I mean, really the West London work, I mean, owed very little to previous art practice.
Yeah.
But we were very conscious of that when doing it.
The notion of nominating the audience before you nominate the methodology.
Well, you see, as soon as the artist moves outside the existing institutional structure, he has a choice. He can specify his own audience. We specified our own audience through a series of reconnaissance trips and decided on four typical social groupings within West London that represented four elements on a decision model that I constructed as a model some a year or so previously. So we were looking for four groups of people who were associated with different levels of decision-making. And we toured around in a car taking photographs and talking to people. I knew the area intimately because I come from West London myself. And from that, the groups we got were one from Harrow, one from Greenford, Hamble, and one at Austerlitz. Each area had to be sort of socially consistent and rather contained in the sense that they were obviously delineated by a number of streets and things like that.
Another point about the West London Project and, you know, social resource projects in general is the way in which they do involve a specific group, which admittedly do have kind of secondary audiences and audiences of a third and fourth hand nature. It would seem interesting if the scale of the project could be increased.
Yeah, there was a limit always to the number of people that become involved. Yeah. It was limited not only by the sort of resources that were available to do the work, but simply by how many people that were there to help me operate the work. I think something that we haven't mentioned was that while there might be myself and participants, there are also people helping me to do the work. And in the case of the West London project, there were some 20 people helping me. In the case of the Edinburgh Works, I'm 40. I mean, it was a rather large organisation to function with. If you increase the numbers of people that are participating, I mean, this work, you know, requires very active forms of involvement. You know, you'd have to increase the number of people that were engaged in helping you to do the work. I mean, the work was really, the relationship between the participant and the work was one of interpersonal relationships between the project operators, i.e. the people who are helping me do the work, and that of participants. A person could physically only go and discuss with somebody the project, could only physically discuss with, you know, X number of people the concerns of the project in one night. I think it was generally about five or something before he began to dry up. In collecting responses, you know, that he could physically only collect so many in a certain amount of time. Actually, one point that's quite interesting is that as the works developed, like the West London work, so the personal relationships between, you know, the project operators and participants gradually developed. And this meant that it took longer to engage in the routine activities of the project. For instance, you know, when one went round to gather responses from the remodelling book, you know, this, it took much longer to physically do than gathering responses from the manual, because people asked you in and you had a cup of tea and discussed the project and other things as well, and personal relationships began to really sort of develop quite strongly in some cases. So there's that aspect of the work, which, all of which would begin to limit the numbers of people that could actively engage in such a work. I think you would have to then get into using perhaps slightly different methodologies.
One of the interesting things that I think comes into the arena of discussion on this point is the way in which, for instance, advertising uses methodologies which are in some sense similar, but they use them toward a controlling direction and a manipulative kind of direction, whereas in the works, you know, you use them very much contrary. You know, you might use the same methodologies, but very much toward a contrary objective.
Quite. I mean, the same methods that are used towards sort of determinism, if you like, can be utilised in a work that, you know, has quite reverse types of objectives. Yes, it was seen that the much higher levels of performance, if you like, could be obtained by utilising the methods of communication techniques developed in other disciplines. After all, advertising has been engaged in communication in the society generally, with a casual audience or a specific audience, depending on the kind of approach. But I mean, it's been engaged in the business of communication for quite a long while, and the methodologies that have adopted, I think, are useful to the artist as a basis, but not to imitate necessarily. I mean, he's not in the same business,
or to engender kind of conformity.
Well, he's not in the business. I mean, advertising is generally directed at perceptual conformity. I don't see that this is the artist's position in society at all.